Welcome into the KSRO Kitchen. I'm Steve Garner, along with John Ash. That's Chef John Ash. For 30 years, John and I have hosted the Good Food Hour starting in October 1987. And here we are 30 years later.
I know, and if you saw our pictures in 1987, we haven't changed a bit.
We, in about 2000, I guess it was 2012, maybe five, six years ago, we struck up a friendship with Chef Rob Lippincott, who was opening a restaurant called the Parish Cafe in Healdsburg. We had first met Rob at some farmers markets many, many years ago, and he is a force of nature celebrating all things Southern in New Orleans specifically. And about a year ago, we got word that Rob was thinking about possibly looking for a spot in Santa Rosa. Now, you know how long things take.
Especially in Santa Rosa.
In Santa Rosa. Yeah. But we have been hounding Rob for the past year. Like, well, give us some updates.
When
and if it's ever going to happen. And on the line with us is Chef Rob Lippincott. Good morning, Rob.
Morning, gentlemen. How you doing?
We're doing good. We call you the king cake guy around here. What is the latest news on the opening of Parish Cafe Santa Rosa?
Well, the latest news is that there's about 300 people standing in front of there right now trying to get a 10-ounce pour of Pliny the Younger.
Oh, of course, of course, yeah. Well, that's a good thing, isn't it?
So there is our location. We're right on there on 4th Street on the intersection of 4th and D. And we've been plugging away in there. We finally got our permits back in November, and the work has been nonstop. And we are close, gentlemen. Our goal is to get this shop open by the end of February. And so there you have it.
So you're about
open here in the next 4 weeks.
Okay. So you're not going to make it for Mardi Gras.
Boy, that was our plan, but it's just not going to happen. Mm. Wasn't in the cards this year.
Okay.
So will this be like the Healdsburg location, only open for breakfast and lunch?
That's correct. We're going to start out with the same program we have in Healdsburg, which is weekday breakfast from 9 to 11:30. And on Sundays, we serve breakfast all day from 9 to 2. And then we have lunch from 11:30 to 3 o'clock on weekdays. So, yeah, 9 to 3. Same menu, and then we'll evolve with the new market down there, and we'll just see what the community wants from
So you know, I sing your praises all the time, because one of the things that happens to chefs, which I don't need to tell you, is that they just burn out, you know, and especially working nights and doing all of that kind of stuff. And you were so smart to sort of say, nope, I want to have some family time and do a good job during the day and not be tied to that millstone.
Well, yeah, you know it, and I did that for a long time. And my wife and I decided, because we're a team. We are a true partnership, and this business wouldn't be without her and all of her diligence. But we decided that's right. That was not the life for us. We have three beautiful children, and I want to sit at home at the dinner table and cook dinner for my family.
Well,
so that's what we do, and we're blessed that it's working.
Good.
It's funny because John and I were talking a while back. We've both been around Santa Rosa for a combination of about 90 years between the both of us. And we were talking about it's been so long since we've had Creole Cajun-style restaurants, remember?
Yeah.
And we were reminiscing. Back in the mid-early 90s, there was a place called Sweet Georgia Brown's in Montgomery Village.
That's right, that followed John Ash and Company in there.
Which, when John's restaurant left Montgomery Village, that opened about 25 years ago or something like that. And the other place that was really good was called Continental Cajun. Do you remember that, John?
Oh,
down on Montgomery Drive in a little shopping center. And that lasted for about a year. And these guys were from New Orleans. We're looking back 25 years. But since then, we have not had really a restaurant dedicated to this style of food in Santa Rosa. So thanks.
Yeah, well, no, I appreciate that, and we're so excited. You know, like you said, we started the farmers markets back in 2009, and it's just amazing the evolution. And in 2012, we opened in Healdsburg, and we're halfway into our fifth year now.
Wow!
And it's just been a great ride, and we're so excited to be to be, you know, entering this larger market down in Santa Rosa and be able to spread the New Orleans love down there, because that's really what we do. You walk in my joint and you know you just entered something unique and special and unlike anything that you've seen.
So is the menu the same, similar, same?
Yeah, you know, beignets and po'boys. Yeah. And then breakfast, we're heavy on our Benedicts, you know, our eggs nouvelle. That's the lump blue crab meat, sauteed in garlic and white wine, served with toast points and poached eggs. And, you know, just that reminiscent, you know, uptown New Orleans brunch. And then, you know, for lunch, you got the seafood platter, fried catfish, oysters, shrimp. You know, French fries and bacon cheddar hush puppies. Mm-hmm. And all of our seafood is sustainably sourced out of the Gulf of Mexico, Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi Gulf Coast. It's all fresh and delicious and the very best ingredients.
Are you going to do king cakes out of the Healdsburg location?
You know, we did that the last few years, and this year we're gonna take a year off of that. And it's just because I'm not able to do it exactly the way I want, and so I just don't want to put out a product I can't be 100% behind.
Sure.
But I tell you what, my mama sent me a king cake from Randazzo's Bakery in Louisiana. I got home last night, opened it up, and I probably ate more than half of it, but don't tell me.
Isn't that nice of mom?
Looking for that little baby Jesus, huh?
I know. It was a great surprise.
Well, what a sweet mama to remember her boy out here in sunny California.
Yeah, I know.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, why don't you just keep us in the loop when the grand opening's happening, and we'll have you back, and we'll celebrate the grand opening of the parish in Santa Rosa.
I will. And y'all, I really appreciate giving me this opportunity to talk with you. And really quickly, Mardi Gras Day, we're not going to be able to have our big bash we normally do in Healdsburg because a little construction project going on there, the roundabout.
Will it ever be finished?
I'll let you know. When we see the unicorn flying by, we'll know it's done. But we are going to be having some Mardi Gras Day specials. Our regular business hours, and I'll be out there boiling live crawfish if you want to come get your fix.
All right, Chef. Nice talking to you. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call.
Nice talking to you. Have a great one.
All right, Chef Rob Lippincott from the Parish Cafe. We'll take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll dive into Wine and Place, a Terroir Reader. Chef John Ash and Steve Garner in the Chaos Ordo Kitchen.
Weather every 10 minutes mornings, every 30 minutes all the time on FM News Talk Radio, 103.5 FM and 94.5 FM, KSRO.
Highway heroes needed immediately. We've all been there. Keys locked in the car, flat tire or out of gas, dead car battery, or you need a tow. Wouldn't it be rewarding to be the champion that makes a difference in that person's day?
Creams Towing is a leader in the industries of transportation and safety. They're looking for people with the ambition and drive to continue to keep Creams ahead of the pack. Are you a Class A driver looking for a great company to work for? Interested in learning the towing business? Creams is expanding and wants to add several drivers. With the largest fleet of medium and heavy-duty transport vehicles in the area, including a state-of-the-art 50-ton wrecker, you'll learn from the best. Openings for Class A and C. Creams will teach the right candidates.
Do honorable work and be a hero on the highway. Call Arlene at Creams, 588-1250. Competitive compensation and benefits. Creams Towing, 588-1250.
Do healthy eating habits fit into your New Year's resolution? Then shop the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market for fresh local produce. It's important to know where your food comes from, and you can meet the local farmers and ranchers who raise quality, locally grown food products for you to enjoy. At the market, you can savor a variety of delicious prepared foods. The market offers fresh local ingredients for healthy dinners, a variety of quality meats from beef, chicken, and pork to seafood, along with seasonal fruits and vegetables. Taste the local goat cheese from Two Rock Valley Goat Cheese. Sample the wonderful baked goods, jams, spices, and pastas. Everything you need to create memorable, healthy dinners is at the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market. Open year-round, rain or shine, Wednesdays and Saturdays, 8:30 till 1 at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, where it's always fresh, local, and fun.
Since the devastating wildfires, many of us have returned to our normal routine. But for thousands who suffered losses, like Carl, life continues to be a challenge.
Through a good friend, we're living in a duplex. It's just not home, though. It doesn't feel right.
Morrow Archer and Associates and their team of nationally respected lawyers and professionals have uncovered strong evidence that PG&E is to blame.
I was not surprised, to be honest with you. You know, I've seen things around our area, and this was just a recipe for disaster, and sure enough, it was.
Each week, this compassionate team of lawyers present town hall meetings to help you understand your rights. Carl attended and found hope for the future.
I believe in them strongly, and I'm hoping other people step forward as well. I think the outcome will be positive for all of us.
If you were affected by the fire, you deserve compensation. To learn more and for dates of upcoming town hall meetings, visit pgelawsuit.com or call 707-237-2445. Gary Morrow of Morrow Archer & Associates, LLC, is the attorney responsible for the content of this commercial.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
In the KSRO kitchen, I'm Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash, and I will have you do the honors of introducing our other John who's joining us today.
Well, John and I, this is John Bixenstein, and we've known each other for longer than you and I have known each other, maybe, or maybe not, I don't know, but 30 years, 25 years or something like that. And actually, we're in business together. We did a little wine venture called Sauvignon Republic, mm-hmm. in which John was, he got the best part of that. He was the traveling winemaker and got to go all around the world. We made Sauvignon Blanc only. And it was a true, and it's mentioned in the book, it was a true exploration of terroir and what that is. So it's prophetic that you should have finally finished this book.
Thank you very much. How often does one get to have chief explorer as their job title on their business card, which was my title at the time? So,
and the new book is called Wine and Place, A Terroir Reader. It's new. Just mm-hmm. came out a few weeks
just
ago.
Just came out a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
You bet. It's written by you and the late Tim Patterson.
Yes, Tim.
And this is quite a different style of book, which I sure enjoyed. It's not just you two guys spouting off about the terroir. It's a lot of brilliant wine writers and winemakers and are very articulate people adding what terroir means to them.
Well, we approach this subject with deep humility because I'm a winemaker, but somewhat of a scientist, and Tim is a brilliant journalist, and very knowledgeable about wine science himself. But we didn't know nearly all of the facets of this issue, and so we searched the world of literature and found people who were great spokespersons for it, and also people who were naysayers. We wanted to point out all the different points of view. So,
well, what the first question is?
Well, the first question is, what is terroir? Of course, that's what the book is devoted to.
What is terroir? Yeah. Well, if you're a terroirist, of course, you know well what it is. Terroir is the flavors of a place. We were talking in the break about Steve's wife who likes a particular kind of tamale, was it, from a certain neighborhood in Chicago, and yep. she'll only go there to have it because those are the flavors she grew up
with. Even though it's a terrible tamale.
No, it's a great tamale.
it's a different tamale.
Yes, dear. But the flavors that you grow up with in a place, the flavors that vintners develop from the grapes that they grow in special places, not always, but sometimes, show a signature of that place. And so that's what terroir is. It's a collection of flavors. It's a flavor profile that we come to taste as indicative of the place where that wine was made and those grapes were grown.
And has that word always been around since the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries?
No, actually not. I am going to do a little separate project. I'm trying to find a good etymologist, who also knows French, to help me really develop the history of how that word arose. But grape growers and winemakers have had a sense of terroir for probably a couple millennia. As the Romans shoved their way around Europe and other civilizations and monastic societies sort of kept grapes alive during the Dark Ages, people developed a sense of where grapes not only grew well, because you had to have success and not have your vines die in the winter, but also where they seemed to blossom forth and give special flavors. And so it's been a long, over centuries, a gradual sorting out of where those places are, what those flavors are, but the word terroir itself didn't actually come into use until the late 1800s or early 1900s, and originally it was a pejorative word. If your wine had terroir, that means it tasted like the barn or the soil in the barn. But gradually it morphed into a word that was more and more positive.
So one of the, it's interesting because of the things that you presented, the both sides of this. There are those who use terroir as a way to elevate their wines and their wine experience, and then there are those who are kind of believe that it's all a bunch of BS anyway, and that it's just a marketing trick.
Well, you know, I use an interesting program that anybody can use called Google Ngrams, and I tracked the rise in usage of the word terroir from over the last 50, 60 years or so. And in the last 20 years, the graph goes up like Mount Everest. It's just amazing. So terroir has become a marketing concept, a marketing word. Everybody and their brother and sister and cousin have terroir. Our wines have terroir. Our vineyard has terroir. We planted here because we knew that we would have terroir. So when in fact, I don't know that we've had long enough in many of our New World sites to really understand what those flavors are like. In many cases, our terroir is human manipulated terroir.
You have a whole chapter devoted to marketing in the book.
Oh, yes, we do. Yes, yes.
Which is great. And I like that you did include the naysayers, the terrorists, and the counter-terrorists who are saying it's a bunch of hooey. But everyone talks about it and everyone writes about terroir.
But it's not essential. I think that was another thing that you pointed out in the book, and that others have pointed out, that terroir isn't the end-all, be-all for good wine.
No, absolutely not. I drink wine every day, sometimes even for breakfast. And I know Chef Ash does. There are millions and trillions of gallons of just wonderful wine, everyday drinking wine, and wine does not have to have terroir as a prerequisite. I'll take a really nice, well-made wine any day. But isn't it interesting, in the world of graphic arts and in the world of visual things that we see, to walk into a museum and see a special painting, and instantly you know where that came from, the genre that it's painted in, probably the century it was painted in, even who painted it, because of the specific intricacies of that painting. You pick up a glass of wine, and all of a sudden you say, oh my gosh, remember in 1986 when we were in the south of France and we visited that one little place, and it was the flavor in that wine that brought that vivid memory of being there back to our brains. Right. Our smell memories are very, very deeply embedded, and they're very specific to a place in some cases.
You in the introduction in the book, you have these theses on terroir, and one that I'm going to throw at you is, because we hear it all the time. I mean, we've had, I can't tell you how many winemakers on the show who've sort of said, well, great wine is made in the vineyard. And here's a quote from you guys. You say, great wines are made in the vineyard. We wish to point out that great wine is, in fact, never made in the vineyard. It's made in the winery.
Well, you know, I think there we're kind of railing against the sense that wine makes itself. And in fact, if you look in the history and definitions chapter, you see that a lot of the older definitions of terroir, as it became a word of usage, were the flavors of the soil and the geology and whatnot, and they completely overlooked or discounted the human aspect. But in fact, humans decided what to plant where. Humans decided this doesn't work here. We're going to plant this instead. Humans decided how to prune it and train it and irrigate it if necessary, and how to receive it at the winery and what to do with it after that. So, I think most winemakers would agree that while winemaking can be seen maybe as best a work of benign neglect, where you allow the wine to show itself and show what the vineyard gave you, you still have to be vigilant. So I call it vigilant benign neglect, where you stand back and watch the wine develop, but you have a plan for it and you safeguard it so that it doesn't fall into bad company or bad microbes or bad situations. And you do, behind the scenes, make the decision about the direction that the flavors take.
One writer called the winemaker's role one of passive alertness.
There you go. I love that. Passive alertness. Yeah. It's kind of like the lizard brain. You're slumbering along through the months with the wine, but you are very alert to anything that might happen, and you know in advance what possibly could.
So one of the people that you quote in here is Matt Kramer. Mm-hmm. I especially enjoyed reading his thing about, which I guess he called somewhereness. Mm-hmm. And he uses the example of Burgundy as perhaps the place on the planet in which terroir is most prevalent. That it's there that you can distinguish those. Is that true?
It's kind of where the concept in the modern era at least developed. The modern era being 18th and 19th centuries, the little postage stamp sized vineyards in Burgundy were seen to each have separate flavor profiles, and in fact, on our book cover is a picture of a Burgundy vineyard with little vineyard blocks going up the hill and showing how you can actually look at it and see how each one of them might have a little different slope or different exposure. And the Burgundians really were the ones that I think swept forward the concept of terroir. There's a good reason for that, perhaps. In the latter part of the 19th century, le goût de terroir meant in local usage that somebody was tasting the flavor of dirt in your wine, and that was actually not a good thing. So
Matt Kramer also said that it wasn't until the late 1960s that really technical expertise began to really become prevalent, that everything was kind of a crapshoot until the late 60s or so. Would you
that's
agree
right.
that technically there were a lot of advances during that decade?
Oh, that's right. In our early days, mine and my fellow winemakers' early days of tasting Burgundy, it was a real shot in the dark. We always get on our knees and pray that in this blind flight we would have one good one. And of course, there have been books and books written about that, the Holy Grail of winemaking or the Heartbreak Grape and so forth. So it's difficult to make a wine from a grape that is so sensitive to human interaction and not overdo it.
So, this is not the focus of the book, but isn't it true that all things that we grow can have an expression of terroir? I mean, I think about tomatoes. I have a good friend in New Jersey who tells me, California, you think you have good tomatoes. Wait till you taste a tomato from New Jersey.
You know what? That's absolutely true. I've had Vidalia onions, and I've had Vidalia onions from Georgia, mm-hmm. from that county, and I've had Vidalia onions from elsewhere, and they're not the same. Mm-hmm. They're not the same. The reason that we go on and on about this terroir development concept in wine is that wine seems to take it to a very, very special level. You really can't taste the flavors of the final wine in the grape. It takes that transformation by yeast, and much of what becomes the flavor and the profile of terroir is actually added by the yeast using the starting materials and the precursors that are in the grapes and grape juice. So it's very much something that is done with the agricultural product that is grown in a certain place.
We need to take a break at that point. We will come back and jump back into the book with John Bixenstein and John Ash, the two Johns. The new book is called Wine in Place, A Terroir Reader. I'm Steve Garner in the KSRO kitchen. Back after this.
It's tax time, and I've got some great news. Did you know if your household earned $54,000 or less last year, you can receive free tax preparation from United Way's Earn It, Keep It, Save It program? Just dial 211 to make an appointment. They'll tell you what you need to bring and where to go. Get your taxes done for free and make sure you get the largest refund possible. Being a U.S. citizen is not a requirement. This message is sponsored by United Way of the Wine Country. Earn it, keep it, save it. Visit UnitedWayWineCountry.org to learn more.
Do healthy eating habits fit into your New Year's resolution? Then shop the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market for fresh local produce. It's important to know where your food comes from, and you can meet the local farmers and ranchers who raise quality, locally grown food products for you to enjoy. At the market, you can savor a variety of delicious prepared foods. The market offers fresh local ingredients for healthy dinners, a variety of quality meats from beef, chicken, and pork to seafood, along with seasonal fruits and vegetables. Taste the local goat cheese from Two Rock Valley Goat Cheese. Sample the wonderful baked goods, jams, spices, and pastas. Everything you need to create memorable, healthy dinners is at the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market. Open year-round, rain or shine, Wednesdays and Saturdays, 8:30 till 1 at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, where it's always fresh, local, and fun.
Sonoma County's most accurate, dependable forecast with KSRO's Daniel Trucios.
Sunny weekend continues today, topping out at 76, 69 on the coast. A few clouds tonight, low 46, 49 on the shores. Some clouds for Sunday at 74, 69 in Bodega Bay. A few more clouds for Monday at 72, 69 on the coastline. Depend on weather every 30 minutes on FM News Talk 103.5 and 94.5 KSRO.
In the KSRO kitchen, I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash. And John Bixenstein is in the KSRO kitchen today, celebrating the release of his new book. It's called Wine and Place, A Terroir Reader, written by John and the late Tim Patterson. We're just getting into defining terroir, whether it exists, what it means, why it's important, whether it is important or not.
Yeah. So we were saying during the break, we were talking a little bit about why you did this book. And I was saying to you that this opened me up to how much has been written about, over the ages, actually, about terroir. So what prompted you to do this?
Well, this has been sort of a pebble in my shoe ever since the very beginning. When I was a Berkeley student eons ago, and also a big wine aficionado, the wine that kind of turned my light bulb on was a Châteauneuf du Pape. And I'd never tasted anything quite as exotic as that before, because my experience prior to that was very California-centric. And so that sort of led me down the path of discovering those Southern Rhone reds and whites and falling in love with Syrah. And so my first job out of Davis eventually was at Joseph Phelps. Why? Not for the great Cabernets that they make, but because they were the only ones making and bottling and labeling a wine Syrah at the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a whole other story there, which I won't go into. But that was kind of my obsession for a long time. And I finally realized that it was not just because it was Syrah, but it was because of the special flavors that certain Syrah exhibited. And so it sort of went on from there. And Chef Ash and I, with, along with Paul Dolan, started a company called Sauvignon Republic, where we were exploring the terroir-driven flavors of Sauvignon Blanc in different places in the world. And that's when this obsession with terroir really sort of broke forth. And I was at a American Society for Enology and Viticulture meeting in Portland, maybe about 10 years ago. And I already knew Tim Patterson and his wife, Nancy Freeman. And I bumped into him in between sessions. And we dove into a bar and sat down, had a glass of wine. And I said, you know, I got something that's really bugging me. And I don't know anybody else who could maybe express my thoughts or write about it as well as you. So would you like to hear my idea? And so we sat down and we had two or three glasses of wine. I don't think we ever went back to the sessions. But the idea was that we needed to slug this out, this concept. We needed to delve into it. We knew that most of our friends or acquaintances or colleagues thought it was total BS. But we were passionate about it ourselves. But we thought, let's just go ahead and mine the world of literature and see what's out there. And let's see if UC Press might be interested in this concept.
Mm-hmm. The book is divided into chapters: After the Lure and Promise of Terroir, then the History and Definitions. Third chapter is Soil. The fourth chapter is Climate. The fifth chapter is Grapevines. And I like one of the quotes in the Grapevines chapter. It says, and we'll see if you agree with this, it says, for any wine, whether or not it expresses terroir or not, virtually all the flavors in the bottle are the product of the vines.
And the yeast. But okay. But originally, yes, the vines. I mean, the vines provide the starting material.
But that's something that's sometimes overlooked. There's all these other, it's climate, it's geography, it's elevation, it's rainfall, it's the wind, it's the number of total solar units per, no, ultimately, right?
It's what the vines put out given their input from all the things that you just listed.
Okay.
You could take the same clone of Cabernet, for example, and you could plant it in 10 different places. And even though the clone would maintain its clonal nature, let's say, unless of course it evolved over decades, the wines that came forth would probably all taste different. Even if you could somehow magically use the same winemaker in each place and make the same wine under the same conditions. Many of them would probably taste alike, but some of them would taste distinctively different. I was thinking about this on my drive down this morning. What if you had quintuplets, let's say, and identical quintuplets, and for some reason, I don't mean to sound heartless about this, but let's say the family was broken up, and one was raised in Seattle, and one was raised in New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
and one was raised in Boston, and one was raised in Houston, you know, and all over different parts of the globe, and they met each other 20 years later. You know, they're still going to be identical twins, but they're going to dress differently. They're going to have an accent. You know, they're going to like different foods. That one from Chicago would like those tamales, probably. So it's very, very interesting the effects that a place can have on a plant and on a human. So in one point in the book, we discuss nature and nurture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely a combination of both.
And that was the nature versus nurture.
Nature versus nurture, right. And which one?
So one of the things you said that's kind of controversial, because we all want to believe that sustainable practices in the vineyard yield better wine. We've heard that from everybody. And by sustainable, I mean, you know, organic or biodynamic or something. That you get better wine, but it tastes better and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And you say no.
Well, I've been in a lot of blind tastings, and you have too, where, you know, we've wines that have been produced by various farming philosophies have been interspersed in a blind tasting, and really, it's hard. You can't tell the difference. In my humble opinion, once you see what they are, you can say, oh, yes, now I taste the difference. But blind tasting, perhaps not. That's not to discount any particular method. Yeah, the more organic, the better. Absolutely. I mean, on your previous show, you were talking about nicotinamides in plant insecticides and so forth. And, I mean, all kinds of things can affect the livelihood of a of a vineyard. So probably the more natural in the vineyard, the better. The Burgundians discovered about three or four generations ago that their soil was dead. It was dead. They were spray. If you went in the vineyards in the 50s and 60s, their vines in the summer, their vines looked turquoise because of all the copper sulfate they were spraying. If you were to dig down in their soils, you couldn't find any microbes or any healthy soil-borne organisms growing. And they really turned things around. They've brought their soils back to life. And I think the biodynamic movement is one of the things that's helped that, but also the organic sensitivity in general.
We need to take a break at that point. When we come back, you've brought a couple wines that express,
I did indeed.
Okay, we'll taste a couple of those when we come back. A special session of the Good Food Hour featuring John Bixenstein, who's wrote with Tim Patterson, the late Tim Patterson, wrote the brand new book, Wine and Place, at Terroir Reader. It has dozens of the finest minds, both here and abroad, writing about what they believe terroir is and what it is not. If you love wine, if you're a winemaker, well, obviously, and she should have this book. But anyone that's passionate about wine should own this book. One of you will have the opportunity to win an autographed copy at the end of the show. Steve Garner, along with, that was beautiful. John Ash on KSRO.
North Bay play-by-play home of the Golden State Warriors and Oakland Raiders. FM News Talk Radio 103.5, 94.5, KSRO.
Hey, Sonoma County. This is George Adair with Bay Equity Home Loans, and I'm proud to present a loan program exclusively offered by Bay Equity. We call it Giving to Heroes. Giving to Heroes is a loan program offered to our local heroes, including firefighters, teachers, police officers, public safety, veterans, and healthcare professionals. Active or retired, Giving to Heroes from Bay Equity Home Loans is giving back to those who serve our country and our local community. If you're considering buying or selling, or even refinancing your home, you may be able to save thousands of dollars. For details and availability of this wonderful program, please visit the Giving to Heroes website at givingtoheroes.net or call us at 707-583-8100. Again, 583-8100. Bay Equity is your home for loans. Call 583-8100.
Equal housing lender subject to credit approval. NMLS ID 76988. The transaction will be made pursuant to the Department of Business Oversight California Finance Lender Law and or California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. NMLS ID 245370.
This month at Graton Resort and Casino, we're giving away a new truck, cash, and more. Multiplier Wednesdays, get up to 7 times the points. On Thursdays, turn points into slot play and win up to $30,000 in prizes. And enter the Tundras and Cash giveaway on February 25th. You could win a Toyota Tundra. Plus, sign up for Graton Rewards and you could get up to $500 in free play. Learn more at GratonResortCasino.com. Complete rules available at the Reward Center.
Results may vary, not a solicitation for legal services. If you owe the IRS back taxes, payroll taxes, or have not filed your returns, the IRS will get you. They can take your property, take you to court, even put you in jail. With one call to WAL, you'll never need to talk to the IRS again. Our average client settles for about 10% of what is owed. We offer free face-to-face consultations in your local area. Call 800-727-0433. That's 800-727-0433.
KSRO. AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
It's KSRO. We're in the KSRO kitchen. Actually, we're in the KSRO wine cave today with John Bixenstein and John Ash. So, John B., why did you choose this wine to illuminate terroir?
Well, this is a Gewürztraminer from Alsace. And, in fact, it's the 2012 Trimbach Gewürztraminer. Gewürztraminer is grown all over the world. It's grown in Germany, just quite a few hundred miles to the east of Alsace, right? And it's grown in other parts of France. It's grown in the New World, both northern and southern hemispheres. But it, every place it's grown, it seems to me, to my palate, to be markedly different. And you taste this and you say, oh, my goodness. This is very, this is spicy, this is grapefruity, this is very likely Gewürztraminer, but why is it so full-bodied? Mm-hmm. Why is it so rich? Why is it unctuous? And you see, because nowhere else that I taste Gewürztraminer, other than in this glass, is quite this rich. Ah, you say, I bet somebody was able to ripen this Gewürztraminer to a level that is what's supporting this richness. So you think to yourself, aha, where in the world does Gewürztraminer and do other aromatic whites, where are they afforded a lengthened growing season? And of course, you settle on Alsace, which is in the rain shadow of the Vosges Mountains. So hundreds of miles to the southeast, where Germany is getting rained on and has to pick its grapes at 18 or 19 bricks, if they're lucky, this is able to go to a full, what we would call in the Western world, full ripeness, 23, 24, 25, even sometimes to Vendange Tardive, late harvest mm-hmm. styles, because they're spared the rain, because the rain leapfrogs over the Vosges Mountains and rains on Germany every day. So you say, oh, okay, that's probably it. But then when you taste it, again, in the late palate, mm-hmm. you notice a very interesting phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Let me go ahead and do that.
Yeah.
There's a little dry patch, a little pithiness, a little traction on the back palate. That's kind of like the pith underneath a grapefruit skin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good description.
And you say to yourself, well, that settles it. Winemakers in the New World wouldn't have the nerve to ripen Gewürztraminer that ripe and leave that little background bitterness in it. With no offense intended to people, of course, who are, but that tends to be a hallmark of somebody in the old world who feels that little traction, that little tiny level of phenolics is necessary to balance all that fruit-forward sweetness, whether it's actual sweetness or apparent perceived sweetness in this Gewürztraminer.
So you're recommending for our listeners that they want a real taste of terroir and be able to taste some of these nuances to pick up a bottle of this. Say the wine again.
It's Trimbach, T-R-I-M-B-A-C-H. Classic, you'll find it at Bottle Barn, I'm sure. But so what I'm saying here is not that I could pick out Trimbach as a specific producer, but I could pick out a regional flavor profile that is within probably a two-hour drive up and down Alsace from Riquewihr to Ribeauvillé to some of the villages in Alsace. And you can say, wow, they're growing their grapes with this same exposure, this same extended dry ripeness period, and this is what it's giving them in their wine.
What does this go for retail approximately?
I'm thinking 20-25.
Very affordable.
But, yes. that's the full-on price.
That's the full-on price. Is 25.
So you could get it cheaper than that.
Yes.
And this is an explosive flavor, tremendous bottle of wine for mid-20s. You had a couple questions for
Well, the chapter on winemaking, you make the point that it's often left out in the discussion of terroir because terroir is all about the place that the things are. But that winemaking maybe is more important than winemaking techniques are really kind of even more important than, you know, where the climate is and what the soil type is and all of that stuff.
Well, if I seem to lean that way, I'm a winemaker, of course. but also, if you look at the traditional definitions of terroir, people throw it out sort of glibly and they say, well, yeah, it's all about the rocks that we have in our vineyard, or it's about the soil, or it's about the, you know, the this or the that, or it's about this severe exposure in the volcanic rock underneath and so forth. And yes, that's part of it. But all of these definitions of terroir leave out the human element. And we talked about this a little bit earlier, but of course the main human element is the winery, the winemaker, deciding what to plant where, deciding when to pick, how to handle it after it's picked, and how to nurture it into its into the final product. Now, like any product that's a balance of different inputs, if you overemphasize one, and if that happens to be the winemaking, then it really doesn't matter where the wine is from. I see so many labels out there that say such and such a vintage Carneros. And the wine could actually be from Timbuktu, which is in Mali, Africa, by the way, with the amount of oak and butter that's in that wine. The place has nothing to do with it. The place has, but the place is a marketing feature.
Okay.
So we'll talk. Let's talk about the place, but let's just let you taste a very lush candy.
Well said about the winemaking portion. And we have to take a break in a minute or two, but sensory was the chapter 7, and spend a lot of time on the buzzword minerality. What does or doesn't that mean to you, John B?
Well, minerality is a very catchy marketing buzzword. I haven't been to a single tasting in years now where somebody didn't use the word minerality once or twice or lots. The fact of the matter is that vine roots don't uptake minerals. They just don't. And furthermore, if they did, or if the minerals were in the wine, minerals are non-volatile. You can't smell them. You know, you could smell them, I think, if you're reacting them with something or burning them, maybe, but you can't smell minerals. So the claims for minerality in wine actually have to be something else. We don't deny the effect of minerality. We just want to assure you with some good references that minerality is not minerals per se. There's a great geologist at university in Wales named Alex Maltman, who goes through all of the various claims for minerality flavors in wine, and one by one tells you really what it is that you're smelling or what it's probably not that you're smelling or tasting.
We'll take a break at that point. Come back with John Bixenstein. He, along with the late Tim Patterson, wrote Wine and Place, a Terra Reader, and that's exactly what it does. Some of the greatest wine writers and winemakers in the world weigh in on their definition of what terroir is. It's a great read if you love wine. Wine and Place. John Ash and Steve Garner in the KS Arto Kitchen will come back and taste a red that expresses terroir when we come back.
Hello, Sonoma County. I'm Digital Pro Kim Commando, and I'm here Sundays, noon to 3, on KSRO.
Smiling was always tough for me, even at my happiest moments, because of my smile. I never knew about cosmetic dentistry, but now my smile is perfect. Thank you, Dr. Sean Wilson.
I know having a beautiful smile makes everyone feel great. Unfortunately, even if you were born with perfect teeth, they may not be so perfect now. Gaps, fillings, stains, chipped, and discolored teeth can all affect appearance, self-confidence, and quality of life. From tooth whitening to implants, my passion is creating your unique and amazing smile that can even make you look younger.
There is only one dentist that's been voted Sonoma County's best dentist 6 years in a row. There's a reason why. Get the smile you've always wanted. Tell your smartphone to call Dr. Sean Wilson, DDS, and schedule your appointment today.
Calling Dr. Sean Wilson, DDS.
The February issue of North Bay Biz Magazine is out, and you do not want to miss it. This is Lawrence Amaturo, North Bay Biz Mag's new publisher, and this month we take an in-depth look at post-traumatic stress and how it has impacted fire victims and first responders. We dig deep into the new science of maternity care, as well as highlight the latest tips on staying vibrant well into your 90s. And finally, plastic surgeons from around the North Bay share their latest cosmetic procedures. Man, I could use some of that. So pick us up today, or for your free sample of North Bay Biz Magazine, email us at sample@northbaybiz.com.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
In the KSRO kitchen, John Ash, Steve Garner, and John Bixenstein, who co-wrote the book Wine and Place, a Terra Reader. And before we move on to the red, John, a couple more comments about minerality.
We were talking during the break about the term people use, flinty, or gun flint, or struck flint. I got a... I got a device from a local shop called an Anywhere Match. And an Anywhere Match is a bar of magnesium that has a little strip of high sulfur flint embedded in it. And what you do is you shave some magnesium on some dry leaves out in the woods, because you're out of matches, right? And then you strike the flinty side on a piece of steel, and sparks shower down and light the magnesium, which lights the leaves and then lights the twigs and then starts your campfire, right? But I got this because I wanted to smell what struck flint smelled like. And I couldn't find an old blunderbuss rifle for somebody to fire in front of me. So when you strike this flint, you can smell the burnt sulfur smell that you find in some wines. It's absolutely fascinating. You smell the flint and you smell the steel afterwards. And this is a smell, I think, that pops up after a year or two in Sauvignon Blanc, particularly Sauvignon Blanc from Sancerre and Pouilly-sur-Loire, the ones that we call Pouilly-Fumé. They have this burnt match head smell in them, and I think it's from the thiols that make up their flavor chemistry. Once those thiols start to disassemble or deconstruct as time goes by, all of a sudden this little charcoaly, flinty smell rears its head. And it's wonderful. And it's actually the mark of a place.
Describe the red wine we're tasting.
Okay. So we're tasting 2010 Crow's Hermitage. This is the Northern Rhone Syrah. Mm. This is one of the wines, or the category of wines that sort of romanced me way back at the beginning. And this is a delicious wine. It's about 8 years old, almost 8 years old now. But when you put it up to your nose, you get some very interesting smells from this. You smell a burnt log. You smell a forest floor. Mm-hmm. You smell a little bit of an animal smell. Or as my French winemaker friends say, animal. you smell sort of like a wet burlap. I smell charcuterie or sausages. And you think to yourself, oh, my gosh, I wonder what this is going to taste like. And then you taste it, and many of those smells come through retronasally on the palate as well. And it's absolutely complex, interesting wine. Some of these flavors are no doubt due to What some are starting to call the microbial terroir of this place called Crow's Hermitage. And the fact that certain yeast and bacteria are indigenous to the growing area and indigenous to the winery, the wineries where these wines are produced. I don't want to call them spoilage or faulty organisms because they could be, but in some cases they contribute a little bit of a nuance to a wine that gives it the signature of that place. You know, I could probably deconstruct this wine, grow up all these yeast and bacteria in a lab, make Syrah somewhere else in the world, infect it with these things, and maybe I could approximate this. But this is what's happening in a very clean cellar, by the way, Alain Graillot, very, very clean, modern cellar, just in that area. So it's a very, very classic example of terroir flavor from a place.
It really is a unique tasting wine. Mm-hmm. Would you give us your favorite number today, John B., between 1 and 10, please.
7.
Caller number 7 at 636-1350 will win this Wine and Place, a terroir reader written by our guest today, John Bixenstein, and the late Tim Patterson. If you love wine, this will keep you enthralled for days, if not weeks to come. Some of the best minds in the world weigh in on terroir. Caller number 7 at 636-1350 will win this autographed copy. Thank you. This is great. We got about a minute left.
Okay, so this is a really quick one. The chapter that you have on the future of terroir, you talk about, among other things, the change in climate.
Well, regardless of what anybody says these days, and some say not, the climate is changing. I've lived long enough to see it in my lifetime. We've seen it in all the agricultural places in the world. And actually, Patrick Comiskey wrote a great little article recently in the LA Times where he talks about the widening width of the possibility of where grapes can be grown. And in other words, it's encompassing cool places, cool climates that formerly couldn't could not support the growth of grapes. And so I think the future is going to be the gradual morphing of flavors of a place into the new flavors of a place. I think some of the new cold regions like Tasmania and sparkling wines in southern England are going to discover their terroir. And the places like the Northern Rhone, which used to be very, very cold, now it's getting warmer, their flavors are going to morph. I think we'll always have the flavors of a place, but just as growers are going to have to watch what they grow and how they handle it in the vineyard, tasters are going to have to watch how those flavors evolve.
And with that, we want to thank you for coming into this show today.
Oh,
it was
so
absolutely great. We could spend hours with you talking about this new book, Wine in Place, with Terroir Reader. Next week, we journey up to Mendocino. We won't, but they'll be down here, and that's Jeff Stanford from Stanford by the Inn by the Sea there.
Yes,
and the Ravens.
The only vegan
resort
in the
country. Well, the first one, certainly.
Yeah.
And the Ravens Vegan Restaurant. Yeah. They'll be in our KS Arnold kitchen. That's next week. Join me in Garden Talks, Gwen Kilcher and John Ash next Saturday. This is KS Arnold Santa Rosa. Clark Wolf at the table following the news.